Hi, and welcome to the Unhinged History Podcast, the podcast where two compulsive freaks are going to learn history whether you like it or not, and then they're going to join forces and tell each other the stories that they just learned. I'm Teresa, and I might have been Googling the words Angie asked me to help her pronounce.
I'm
And that's
Angie, and I might have told Teresa she better stop it.
because these
For a
stories
split
are a
second, I thought she was
surprise.
reading my screen.
Well, that's genius and that's brilliant. And I would say we should start with yours, but I just looked it up and you did a solo episode last week like a baller, and that would mean it's my turn.
All right. I mean, I'll fight you for it, but we could do it however you want.
I mean, look, my poor husband has had to deal with the no, I know. I've heard of that story. I don't know how you didn't know that story. And then me going, everything we know about the story is wrong. I need help.
What I gotta do? Help me. You can go first. You can go first.
Okay.
Cause trust me, you're gonna. You remember how delightful Clara the hippo was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny that you compare the story I'm about to tell you to Claire the Hippo, which is another story I did, because this is not as sunshiny and delightful and full of hair ribbons.
Oh, good. Then my story wants to go second.
Okay, good, good. Okay, because I'm going to tell you of the Siege of Kaffa.
Okay.
Any ringing any bells?
The name does, but I'm feeling like perhaps it's ringing bells because of Kafka.
Oh, yeah, no.
So
Kaffa is
I'll scream if it stands out.
modern day Theodosia.
Okay.
And that's Theodosia with an F and not Dear Theodosia, what to say to you? No, not that. Okay, so the story idea came from a friend of mine, Susan Harrison, longtime friend, met her on Twitter when Twitter was Twitter and the place to be and not the raging cesspool known as X.
Can we just take a moment to appreciate that in all the news sources that Twitter gets mentioned, it is formally known as like
It's
Prince.
Prince. Yeah, it's now reverted to a symbol.
I'm so happy for it.
Yeah. My news sources are the National Library of Public Medicine. The article is Biological Warfare at the 1346 Siege of Kaffa by Mark Wheelis.
Okay.
And then because I went, wait a minute, I had to reread large portions of The Silk Roads by Peter Frankopan. There's an article from War History Online. And then just for giggles, I had to revisit venture capitalists' infographic of the history of the deadliest pandemics because I needed to be able to wrap my brain around what I was looking at. Okay.
You just really love that website, don't you?
You know, I just like watching, I like rooting for whatever team I'm on. And since COVID-19 is really our home team, I just want to watch us, you know, overtake the next plague.
I mean, yeah. I'm gonna get you a jersey that says COVID-19.
I feel like maybe those who were on the front lines deserve to be the only ones wearing it and deserve maybe discounts and coupons and comped meals everywhere they go, but
I agree with you on that.
not me wearing my face mask and smelling like rubbing alcohol with chapped hands.
Don't miss your favorite perfume.
I mean, like, now don't get me wrong. I was one of those peeps that went, oh, actually, my very niche perfume company has switched to making hand sanitizer and it smells like lavender and a hint of rosemary. I was like, I'm going with that one. And we might still have bottles of it running around the house. Oh, I forgot. There's another article or another source I went to. Bulletin of Atomic Scientists Catapulting Corpses, a famous case of medieval biological warfare, probably never happened. Anyhow, I know, like,
Carry on.
anyhow. Okay. So I really should have like left maybe the names of the articles out so that I could maintain my mystique, but damn it, I info dump. Okay,
And I
so
can't be stopped.
no, I really can't. Okay, so the Siege of Kaffa really kicks off in 1346, but because I really need to settle us into a good understanding where we are in history, I have to back up to 1206.
Oh, dang
I
it.
know, like me and my, I need context. Okay,
It's
so
fair. It's truly, it's fair.
1206 is when Genghis Khan starts his empire.
Okay, yep.
Now, Kaffa is in,
Carry on.
it is on is a port city on the Dead Sea, so pretty far away from the Mongols. Anyhow, you and I both know Genghis Khan was a bit of a badass, and Kiddo and I had to discuss how a good chunk of the modern world is related to him because he did his business. Now,
Because as you do.
right, I mean, he was a bit of a badass and did, yeah. So he, as he was spending his time consolidating all the Mongol tribes and establishing the largest continuous empire, his kingdom reaches from Asia to the Adriatic Sea. And it's like, we know that. But then you look at a map and you go, oh my gosh, that went from Mongolia to Croatia. And to realize, like, he was sitting on the coast looking at Italy, like you do.
I mean,
It was mind blowing as an adult to look at it and go, oh, that landmass.
oh, the one, Alexander the Great, that one,
Yeah.
but
Yeah.
going the other direction.
Exactly, right? Like, and I think we know more truly about Alexander the Great than we do about Genghis Khan.
I
Maybe,
would
you know, from,
100% agree with you.
yeah, very Western view. And the one thing the reason why I had to go back and reread chunks of the Silk Road is because the Silk Road is all about a very Eastern view of history as opposed to a very Western view. And so it talked about how Genghis Khan was very accepting of all major religions. He conquered a new area and it's like, oh, you guys are Muslim. Great. Tell me more about Muhammad. Okay, this is fantastic. Oh, you guys are Christian. I would like to learn more about how Jesus could be my Lord and Savior. Oh, you are Buddhist. Teach me about how to get to Nirvana. And he and his top brass would convert so often to appeal to the local areas that
Right.
he was extremely diplomatic. And when I was telling Kiddo about this, response was, that's kind. I mean, and manipulative, smart. And it was just,
I
I was like, yeah, I mean,
can see your little cylinders firing there.
yeah. And she's kind of like, he's making a bunch of really strategic lies. How lovely, you know?
Lovely. Get
And
it,
it,
Mr. Khan.
right. Like, because you can see she's like, look, I got to prepare for middle school. So, oh,
This is how you
brilliant.
make an alliance. I see.
Yeah. Suddenly the
I love
playground
this
makes
for
more
her.
sense, you know? Well,
Right.
also another thing he did, okay, because he controlled the region of the Silk Roads. He didn't, he didn't own the Silk Roads, but like, hey, basically all that land was his. And all of the port cities that are having goods come in and out, they're taking full advantage and they're taxing the shit out of exports, right? And we would know this. We would,
Text.
it's like modern day us go, of course there's an export tax. But Teresa, looking at a book, goes, oh, taxes, even back in the 1200s, 1300s. Interesting. Now, Italy was making its share of tax revenue as it's sending things out. Alexandria is reported for charging 10, 20, 30% of a good's value for an export tax. But the Khans, they decided that no, they're not going to do that. And since they control the Black Sea, their
I don't know
ports.
why. I am so sorry, but would you refer to them simply as the cons? All, I don't know why, but the first image that came to my mind was the family from Schitt's Creek, and that is now what they look like.
Oh, I mean, it see, at first I thought you were going to say from that early 80s Star Trek movie, Khan, and you're just
Oh,
going to see that
no.
tan, bare chest and mullet.
No, but now, I mean, okay.
All right. I
My
mean,
image is spiraling now. Thanks for that.
I totally just dismantled your Schitt's Creek. Sorry. But anyhow, so since the Khans control the ports on the Black Sea, They're enforcing export taxes from 3 to 5%. So dramatically lower. And so this causes all of the merchants who really care about profit margins to funnel large amounts of trade through the Black Sea ports.
I mean, this checks.
Right. You're going to go where you can, like supply chain and demand. I know I combined a bunch there, but I don't regret any of it. And I think that that's a very clear way to talk about it, even though nobody else ever has. Now, the Silk Roads, the author Frangipane, he talks about how, spices and fabrics and even ideas are just moving through this pathway like you wouldn't believe. Like, the conical hats in the Renaissance paintings? Do you know where those come from?
I mean, I do now because you're asking about it, but I had never thought about it before now.
They were inspired by Chinese hats.
But that checks.
And it was just like, what? Going through the book again, I was like, oh, I forgot about that. That is so bizarre. But this is, the world has been a global economy for a long time, and we fail to recognize that. We are very myopic in our own view. Now, as all of these ideas and all of this money and everything, and the Mongols are controlling the land that is the Silk Roads, silver ends up becoming one of the main staples of bargaining. Because of course you could bargain, I'll trade you a pound of peppercorn for, a bolt of silk fabric. But silver, it almost becomes universal. And so it almost, like just as a weight, almost establishes a very stable trading economy there. And so this just really cements how this is working. Now, there's another very fun and interesting fact I don't think you know about the land that the Khans owned, like the Eurasian steppes. I had forgotten this because I had originally read The Silk Roads a couple years ago, but the Eurasian steppes apparently form what is called the Great Plague Basin.
This also checks.
And you don't see that in the travel guide. You don't go to,
That's not in the pamphlet.
But from the Black Sea to Manchuria, it's basically a haven for Yersinia pestis, which is the bacteria that is transferred from one host to another by fleas and flea bites. Rats and camels are common vectors for this fun little organism. And once the bacteria enter the body, they head to lymph nodes where they cause swelling and hemorrhaging and black bags of blood to form and pool underneath the skin, giving it that fun, reason to call it the Black Death. Now, just to kind of give you an idea at how volatile this area is, one recent study done by poor souls who have higher risk tolerances than I do, they did a study that showed a 1% increase in temperature, or a 1 degree increase in temperature, would lead to a 50% increase in plague bacteria in the great gerbil. So, yeah, this area. And now
Cool.
we have done quite a bit to establish firm trade routes and to funnel people through a very small area where they could trade through efficiently.
Lined with plague.
Yeah. Boiling over in plague, in fact.
Oh, you had to give it that visual, did
You're welcome. So the
you?
Mongols in the late 13th century. Okay, now I'm going to say Mongols. Let me back up, because as we head into this story, I could refer to them as the Tartars. I could refer to them as the Mongols. Theoretically, they are the Tartars, which is an offshoot of the Mongols. I am going to be loosey-goosey with these phrases. Yes, there is a difference. That's my
Live your
disclaimer.
life.
That's my disclaimer. Okay, so the
She
Mongols
will
in the
not be
late.
taking questions.
I mean, you know what? You tell me every time I mess up out loud, don't write it to me, but just speak to your phone, speak to your laptop, speak to your computer system or your stereo system. We'll go from there. And if I change, I change.
Mexican-owned Canada.
Stop it.
Sorry.
That's apocryphal. Anyhow, so late 13th century, the Mongols have allowed a group of traders from the Republic of Genoa to establish trading settlements in the area. Now, this group of Italians, they're living in this,
So sorry.
what?
I don't know why, but the way you said Genoa, my imagination is on fire today. The way you said Genoa gave me this like visual of them meeting the Mongols for the first time and it being like an absolute culture clash of like high society versus bowmen in one go. And I just couldn't because we know that the Mongols are not barbarians.
No.
And so the image just was, it didn't align with what you were saying.
Okay, so the reason why I'm probably saying Genoa differently is because every time I read it, my brain went, Genoa! And I was like, no, it's not that. There's something I'm triggering in my own brain. And it was just the shout of Padua. And then I had to look it up, be like, oh, because in my freshman year of high school, we watched a version, of Taming of the Shrew. And every time Padua was mentioned, which was frequent, all of the auxiliary cast members who were always on stage, hanging from ship riggings or whatever, would just shout Padua. And so my brain kept going, Genua. And I was like, no, it's not Genua. Like they didn't,
Stop it.
different place, different place. Anyhow,
But
so
fair.
group of traders from Genoa, they establish a trading settlement there, and so they're doing quite well. The Italians did do quite well during this period of trade, and due to all of the successes, Caffa virtually monopolizes the trade in the Black Sea region. It is the place to be, and it becomes a major seaport, and it's one of Europe's largest slave markets. Which I was just like, huh, okay. So this is really setting the scene for what we're up against. Now that Mongols, they really benefit from the Genoese businesses in this bustling city because it earns them access to Italy's largest commercial center and stimulates trade across their empire. So this is a win-win for everyone. Now, many of the
I like it.
Muslims, or many, sorry, many of the Mongols have been practicing Muslims from the 1200s. Now, I know I said that the top brass kind of, switched with the chains of winds and wherever they were regionally, but a good chunk of them were Muslim. Now, the Genoese merchants, primarily are Christian, think heavy Catholic, influence there. Now, the discrepancy in religions, occasionally causes disputes. I mean, they would have fought for any reason, I'm sure, but religion tends to lead to a bunch of them. And unfortunately, we're going to have to put a pin in that thought because things are going to continue to bubble and grow and fester, if you will. Now, fast forward to 1343. The Mongol Empire has evolved. The great Khan has had multiple children who have broken off and done their own things. And there is an offshoot that is controlling the Black Sea region. There is an offshoot that controls the Black Sea that is referred to as the Golden Horde, which is the best branding. I'm loving it. I can see the merch already.
I could not agree more with you.
And the
I
leader, go
want
ahead,
it.
right? Like, oh God, black hoodies, gold font. I can see it. Now, the leader of the Golden Horde is a bro named Janny Beg, which
Of course.
you can't make this up. And the fact that his name isn't 17 syllables long is even
Is
better.
really appreciated.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan. And he rules over this group of Tartars. Now, city nearby, City of Tana in 1343, it kind of is the home of a fight. A fight breaks out between some Genoese Christians and some local Muslims. And then one Muslim dude is found dead. And
Oh,
after,
dear.
so the Genoese have played a game of F around and they flee to Caffa because they don't want to find out. You've seen the TikTok sound. I don't want the consequence, consequence, consequence. Yeah, that's the game they're playing.
As they're tiptoeing away.
And
Okay.
Janie Begg is like, no, I'm over this. Like, the consequences are coming. And so he goes to take over Kaffa because Kaffa grants these people protection. And Janie's like, not on my watch. Now, Kaffa turns out to be a bit more reinforced and not as feeble as Janny Begg was really expecting. Because the Golden Horde basically encircles them and they don't cave immediately. They don't just do, like, matter of fact, they're fighting back against the Golden Horde, which good for them. But the Golden Horde is, they've got a certain street cred that they're looking to uphold and that this is really tarnishing things. Kaffa also has access to the sea, and they're able to do kind of things like bring in supplies and reinforcements from Italy. And so this kind of breaks the Mongols, and their first siege ends in tears, and they take their toys and they go home. They're suffering about 15,000 deaths and heavy
Oh,
damage.
wow.
Like, so they're pretty. Janny Begg has some big feels about this. And 1345, so 2 years later, he comes back with reinforcements and he lays siege to Kaffa again. And this
Oh,
time
so he comes
he's
back with his
prepared.
big brother and his friends?
Exactly. He is not
Okay.
playing around. So he also brought something unexpected with him that even he didn't know he was packing. He brought the plague.
Oh, good on him.
And according to an account of events in Crimea, you know, that fun area, the Tartars, they start getting struck violently by this pandemic, and they start falling down on all sides, quote, as if struck by thunder, with lumps on their joints and dark marks on their faces. They developed a putrid fever and were beyond help from neither doctors nor their god.
Oh. That's gnarly.
Yeah. And you got to understand that this is not a good time for medicine. And so they don't necessarily understand how this is spread. And this is good times. Now, the fact that the plague is wreaking havoc and just ripping apart their ranks is fairly demoralizing. And a large bulk of them decide that they're done with this siege and they just want to go home while they can still walk away. But Janny Begg, he's not going to back off, not without giving Kaffa a piece of his private hell. Now, history.com, because I had to look this up, believe that the plague was spread by divine punishment, which is entertaining to me because the group of Muslims that are packing it are fallen down on the job like you wouldn't believe. But Christians are also falling down. So if it is divine punishment, it kind of strikes without deference to
A
God.
care.
Yeah, like regardless of what holy book you read, apparently the gods are all angry.
This is what happens when both sides of the bully fight's moms come out.
Yeah, and they're
You're
just
all
like,
in trouble.
that's it. You know what? You guys are all going to clean up this mess together. No, we're not going to hear any of it. And we're going to put you in a get along shirt. Now, I mean, so another theory that was floating around at the time, that was an unintended pun, was the miasma theory, which was basically like bad air. And that was why, like in an earlier story, when we were talking about the yellow fever breakout in Louisiana, how they were using cannons to try to clear the air. And that was when
I
our
love that
girl,
idea.
Marie Laveau, was like, how about we actually just take care of their bodily needs and maybe wipe down their angry, fevered faces and give them some bone juice?
How about they have some broth and we actually just like open the windows?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's all of that. But I mean, that it just it's par for the course, right? Well, Johnny Begg he, or Janny Begg, he's feeling some kind of way, like absolute tantrum here, because he puts his corpses in catapults and then flings them over the defensive walls of Kaffa.
As you do.
And to me, this is such an adult-sized tantrum. This is the I have broken my own toy soldiers, and I'm so pissed that I'm going to fling them at all the other kids.
I'm going to rip their arms off
Yeah.
and fling them at you.
And it's your fault that I'm doing these things. Now that I can only imagine being a resident of Kaffa, you've had the golden hordes surrounding your village. And now, okay, so let me back. Like there's bodies falling from the sky. Like, you know the song, It's Raining Men. It's raining men. Hallelujah. And then let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the like these
Yeah,
could
you.
both be just wildly different tellings of the exact same story.
I'm never going to be able to hear those two songs the same ever again.
I'm going to make sure we pay a DJ to do a mashup. I don't know how that would turn out, but here we are. Now, these poor people are watching all of this happen. There is a spreading putrid smell that is just all over the place. And nobody can hide or flee from the havoc that rains down. Like, quote, they moved as many rotten bodies as they could, dumping them into the sea as quickly as they could. But by then, it was too late. The Black Death was already in Kaffa.
Thanks for putting it in the ocean, friends.
Seasoning, right?
Sure the sharks loved it.
I don't know if there are sharks in the Black Sea, but now I really hope so. So the
Yeah,
siege,
I didn't
this
think about that. Piranhas, maybe?
piranhas feel like a very South American animal, maybe the Amazon River, and the Black Sea is quite a distance away.
Listen, they're piranhas wearing coats, okay?
Okay, all right. You know what? We're moving on. Piranhas wearing coats. So the siege goes on for like a year and a half, 2 years. And it's at this point that negotiations between the Tartars and the city, establish, and everybody kind of gains their cooler heads, and everybody, kind of packs up their stuff and goes home. But the plague has already firmly set up shop. Now, people are attempting to flee the city via the same fabulous trade routes that have been firmly established, and they bring home souvenirs. So basically, the Siege of Kaffa is the super spreading event of the 1300s.
And it takes 2 years.
Well, I mean, you got to understand, like, the Mongol hordes really have to get decimated. Now, we don't know
Oh, yeah,
exactly at
okay.
what point, the plague really rips through and destroys everything, but the plague itself could off somebody fairly quickly, like to the point
Right.
where, depending on how you got it, it could kill you within 24 hours.
Wow. I didn't realize, I thought it was like a few days. I didn't realize it was. Wow, okay.
Because there were two variations of the cold, depending on how the disease got into your body, which was just like,
Gotcha.
oh, that's brutal. That's like, I've got a cough, it's too late. Like in Milan, the reason why they survived so well is there were like two or three homes where someone kind of coughed and they just bricked up the
Burn them to
home.
the ground.
No, they just
Yeah.
bricked it up. Like
But you're done.
your allergies killed you, Pietro.
Deuces.
Yeah. You're not one of us anymore. But they, Milan like did well because they quarantined hard.
They're hardcore
Right,
quarantiners.
like they were like, we've been preparing for. They were the preppers of Italy, apparently. But anyhow, so people are bringing home souvenirs as they're leaving Kaffa, and this is when like I had to really look at the venture capitalist infographic, because do any idea? COVID has killed in 4 years, roughly just under 7 million to date.
Okay.
How long or how what numbers do you think we're playing with the Black
20
Death?
million. At least 20 million.
At least venture capitalist puts it at 200.
200 million?
Correct.
Holy crap. Okay.
So there's that. Now, okay, so there's some fun debates on whether the event that I just laid out of Jenny Beg throwing bodies over the wall, whether it actually happened, right? how we think it happened comes from this bro named Gabriel de Musy's narrative. Now, he claims that in his narrative, in the account we have from him, that the Genoese inside the fort soon fell ill and they clambered aboard their ships and they fled towards Italy, to Genoa, to Venice, to the other ports, carrying with them the very plague they sought to escape. Quote, as if they had brought evil spirits with them, every city, every settlement, every place was poisoned by the contagious pestilence.
Oh.
Okay, so small problem with that account. The Journal of the Bulletin, or in the article from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the researchers kind of really broke down. This is when I love really geeky people. They broke down the theory of Jenny Beg using catapults to launch remains over the walls. And they're determining that basically it would have been a trebuchet. And that trebuchets.
That is not at all what I thought you were going to say, and I'm so delightful that
Where'd
that's
you
what you
think I
said.
was going? No. Back up one. Where was I going?
I thought you were just going to say, as it is, the story never happened. They never launched bodies over the wall. But no, you were like, it turns out it was a trebuchet. Like, made
Oh,
that
no.
so
Okay.
much funnier.
Yeah, no. Because stay with me there. So a trebuchet can throw an object weighing 300 pounds a distance of 300 yards. So think of 1,000 feet. Now, according to de Musy's account, the catapults were used to fling the bodies over the walls of Kaffa. But, since we can think about, it's not going to be catapults, it has to be trebuchets. Because the quote is from the article, that would be the best of which they could theoretically launch a human payload. And just the phrase human payload was very entertaining to me.
I'm so glad you did this story.
Because it's just because the story starts with, did you know the Mongols engaged in biological warfare? Yeah, no, I knew that, honey. I had forgotten it if I knew it. And then me getting to this part and going, if they did, they had to use trebuchets. And then here's the problem with using trebuchets in this region at this time. No surviving evidence of a trebuchet has ever been found in this area. What's left are historical references and all the drawings, they lack any of this perspective, right? But a group of, basically trebuchet fans on YouTube and researchers, this just checks with my whole life. They've reimagined what the weapons might have looked like, constructed their own variations, and then had modern day recreation or recreations of this.
Dave, I'm gonna need you to sit down.
It's like, well, that oak tree needed to get removed. So Billy and Brian made it into a trebuchet, and now we're launching things into the neighbors' fields.
Hey, it's working. We just need. It's a distance test. That's all we're trying to do here.
I love all of this. I love all of this. Now, apparently, despite what we see on YouTube, these trebuchets are really heavy and they're really hard to move. Whether you disassemble them and reassemble them at place, they're kind of a pain in the ass to carry your siege weapons with us.
I kind of got to build them there, I think.
I mean, and that's kind of where they go through, and they're like, you know what though? You really don't have the trees in the area to have the ability to build your trebuchets on demand. And so that's kind of a problem. And so people are like, well, I mean, if you look at the time, they didn't have access to trebuchets, but, more research indicates that they had access to Chinese catapult technology.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'm here for that. Now, these are smaller trebuchets that could fire 33-pound projectiles at close to 400 feet.
Oh, so we're chopping body parts up, huh?
That's kind of where we're going with this. Now, how angry do you have to be at your army dying that you hack them into pieces and then send pieces over the wall? And how bad of a boss are you? Like, we've all had horrible bosses, but you have a really horrible boss when your boss says, I need you to cut your coworker up into bite-sized pieces and fling those pieces over the wall.
Yeah.
Turn the first
Retirement?
regiment into stew meat and fling him over the
Please.
wall.
Listen, I know you never liked that guy anyway. You had that problem with him back in Kaffa, remember? Like,
Yeah.
yeah.
End it with an
He
axe.
lost that bet. Yeah. Ew.
Now, what they think really happened, like when they zoom out and they really look at this, they think it was basically a medieval game of telephone. Because first off, when we do a deep dive about Dimiusi, where we get this account, they're able to trace and realize Bro wasn't in Kaffa. Bro was in Genoa the entire time.
So he's writing down what someone else told him.
Yeah, so he has a bunch of contact coming in from these traders, coming in and out, coming in and out, coming in and out. So he's getting more and more of these pieces and really trying to put together his own story of, what happened at Kaffa. And he's hearing all of these secondhand narratives, and he's just piling them in with his religious convictions because, these poor Christian men were beset by Muslim
The plague.
Mongols. And then
Yeah.
they like sought refuge in the city of Kaffa, and they were just beset upon all sides. And then these awful people were launching dead bodies into the air so that the putrid smell, because they thought maybe the smell itself would also cause the plague. I
Fair.
mean,
Okay, that's fair.
you have teenage boys. I'm sure the smell you think is sickening.
It's roast 3-day-old roast beef.
I don't like going to stores anymore. I'm gonna avoid the deli department at all costs.
I'm sorry.
I've got a daughter. This is better for me. I'd rather it smell like Bath and Body Works exploded.
There was a short time where it smelled like an axe shop. Thankfully, he got over that quickly. Yeah.
Human funk versus chemical.
Now we just let him sit outside for a few minutes before we pick him up from practice.
We need the outer layer of sweat to harden before you get in and rub your stank everywhere. Please and thank you. But anyhow, basically, Dimiusi, he's thinking that God struck down the Mongols, and then the miasma was brought on by catapulting those bodies. And that's what spread the plague. And that he kind of got enough people telling that story that he kind of put it all together. And then everybody began quoting Dimiusi's account as this being the
This
first
checks.
biological attack. And so
This checks.
it's real fascinating to kind of look at that and go, oh, I see how that would work. And enough people tell the same lie, it becomes the truth.
But it could be just as easy as, I don't know, sending two or three guys with the plague into the city and just hang out there for a few minutes.
Just
I
let
mean,
your
if you're
fleas
gonna
bite
pass
their
it.
fleas.
Yeah. Hang out in the tavern. You're in a populated area. It's gonna spread no matter what.
Right. Lick a couple of doorknobs on your way out and call it a day.
Yeah. We all remember the glitter thing during COVID. This is how it works.
Yeah, glitter spreads. So does COVID. Same, same. But yeah, so that's the story of the siege of Kaffa and what may or may not have really, and I think that's really kind of what I'm bringing to this podcast is like, hey, here's this sensational story, and here's probably how it didn't happen.
And here's how I'm going to ruin all your fun.
My name is Teresa, and I am a buzzkill.
I'm here to kill the buzz. Well, I thank you for giving me all the visuals that you just gave me, including some guy's arm being thrown over a wall. Let's see if I can get this. Do you want to hear my story? I
Yes.
ask you that every week.
I know. And
Okay,
I act
so.
like you're going one day I'm gonna be like, absolutely not.
Keep there. All right, fine. I would tell it anyway. But I actually am really excited to tell you the story. You're gonna be mad at me, but I don't care. The sources are gonna come at two different points because
Because you're not
it
gonna give
has
away
to.
titles of articles like I did.
Yeah, and because it's to like context and then the story, but I don't want to share
You
the
want to bury the
sources
lead.
together. Yeah, because it's more fun this way, trust me.
I mean,
Okay.
I'm now jealous in how you're telling your story.
Trust the process, as my youngest would say.
Oh dear. That
Which
means
I
there's
am
going to be
now
quite the cleanup.
which now I am going to be asking, but does the process know we're trusting it? Half of my sources. And I'm just gonna disclaimer this. There is a word that there's I could not find anybody to pronounce this at all. And so I am doing my best.
Is it a Japanese
Please
word?
don't come at me. I don't think so. I think it's a South Pacific, like Hawaiian type, but anyway. I'm going to pronounce every letter A different in this word because it's the only way it makes sense to me.
I'm
Okay.
afraid.
I know, there's only three A's though, so you're okay. The Battle of Tarawa, World War II facts. Tarawa, the toughest fortified position Marines faced in World War II. Flashback, Japan thought it would take 1 million men 100 years to take this fortified island, but the US Marines did it in 3 days. That is an article by Ryan Pickrell from the Daily Caller.
This checks
And
for
believe it or
Marines.
not, doesn't it? The Marines Twitter feed. I did not know. I didn't know they had a Twitter until this week. And then there.
I want to know what's on it because I have guests and it's all memes and jokes and drunken comments.
Okay, so without giving away my story, I'm going to tell you that what I watched on their Twitter feed was a like, today is the 75th anniversary of this event, and it
Okay.
was truly, it was delightful. Like I got a chuckle out of it and then realized, oh my gosh, I'm watching their Twitter feed. This is hilarious. Like I didn't know this was a thing. And then there is a, which I thought this was so cool. There's a YouTube documentary from World War II from the best archives called The US Marines in Battle of Tarawa. And what's really special about this is it was the documentary they were showing to Americans during the war. So like I know this sounds stupid, but like, you know, like in Captain America, you see him watching a film and he's getting the propaganda reels
Yeah,
before the film, right?
right.
I always appreciated that, but I didn't know like we had access to that until just this like last year. So I've watched my fair share of propaganda reels, having learned that, and this is one of them. So, with all that being said, I'm gonna ask, have you ever picked a story that you were so excited by and then learn something so wildly offhand that you immediately switch lanes? And when I say switch lanes, I mean like you left the country and you drove on the other side of the road type switch lanes because you had to learn all the things right now. And if you didn't tell me the story, you would lose your ever-loving cool.
Oh, multiple times. And I think I might have said, hey, I tried to tell another the barbarian the Bartarian pirates.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This is that for me. I very much was so excited about discussing a completely different topic with you, but then I was having a conversation with Ian last week, and mid conversation, I stumble across this story while looking for something totally unrelated for one of my classes. So we can thank Dr. Clower of Chico State for this. And before you ask, this topic is so wildly different from what I was looking for the class too, that just made it even funnier. Like the how I got here, I made me laugh so hard. Anyway, so time to take a serious U-turn. This might be both the most unhinged story and the funniest that I've ever brought you. At least for me, it was.
I mean, I'm with this intro, I'm here for it.
Right? Okay. So before I get into my actual story, I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory. We're talking about the Pacific Theater and more specifically the Battle of Tarawa. At this point, the US, our ultimate goal from the start of our offensive in the Pacific was to take the Marianas Island, which, you know, they include the islands of Guam, Saipan, Tinian, and Rota.
Okay.
However, The Marianas Islands, they're heavily defended. And to be successful to take those islands, it would take land-based bombers and a staging ground in order to start an attack on these islands. So the U.S. forces start far to the east at Tarawa. Now, Tarawa is the main atoll in the Gilbert Islands. It's approximately 2,000 miles away. So they're like leapfrogging, right? From one place to the next to get to the Marianas. Like that's their end game right here, at least for this regiment. So, like I said, Tarawa is the main atoll in the Gilbert Islands. It's approximately 2,000 miles away. The battle that we're looking at takes place on Baisho, which is an island. And as it turns out, this pointedly glares at me that I don't know nearly enough about the different sizes of island and what makes an island versus an atoll. So just add that to the list of things I need to learn in my lifetime.
I have no idea.
I was like, hold on, how is this one battle in three places? I'm gonna need somebody to draw me a map. And then I realized it's a place within a place within a place. It's like Island Inception.
So, like small series of islands.
There's like an island chain
Yeah.
and then an island area and then a smaller island is the way I understand it. But like listeners, if you could explain atolls to me, I would really appreciate it.
Yeah,
Because
we're
I
going to
think
need
you
a
have the
short
island
video and a
chain.
whiteboard.
Yeah, I think it's the island, the Gilbert Islands is the chain, and then the atoll is Tarawa, and then the main island that this battle takes place on is Baisho. That's how I think it works. But anyway, here we go. So it is also super important at this point to mention that the type of atoll that Tarawa is, it's coral. So during the landing, Marines can't use the standard troop deploying boats like the Higgins boats that we're used to from seeing the Battle of Normandy. Like those, you know, like they can't use those. They won't go over the coral. So that it, like that is really important to know. So, first of all, Tarawa, and specifically Baisho, weighs in at approximately 2 miles long and half a mile wide, and was so heavily fortified with mines, barbed wire, machine gun nests, and pillboxes, along with various other heavy artillery.
Pillboxes?
Pillboxes, like the fighting boxes, they build their machine gun.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that was the name of
Yeah,
it. I'm learning.
so along with all of this, like. And keep in mind, this is only 2 miles long and half a mile wide, and it is just so well fortified. It also houses at least 4,500 Japanese Imperial troops, including the Ryukyushinti, which are the Japanese Marines, or the
Sent.
equivalent of the Japanese Marines. Sentai. Ryukyushinti. Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. The Ryukyushinti. And these guys, they are like top-notch troops, and our Marines know what they're up against here. The Japanese were so confident in the fortifications that Admiral Kaiji Shibusaki said that it would take 1 million men 100 years to take this beach. It is 2 miles long and a half a mile wide. It's going to take 1 million men 100 years.
That is an incredible, like, I want to see the math problem where he worked that out. I mean, I didn't have to do a lot of proofs in high school, but I'm going to need to see the proof on that one.
He's just working with an overabundance of confidence and a strong misunderstanding of U.S. Marines. That's what I think is
About
happening
to
here.
say, you realize that I won't be able to quote where I learned this, but there was a group of airmen that had their barracks at the top floor of a barracks that contained mostly Marines. The airmen received hazard pay for living in that area.
There you go.
Because Marines, but carry on.
Yeah, because Marines, that should be all you need to know from here on out of this story, because
Because
Marines.
Marines.
Yes. So what Admiral Shibusaki doesn't know is that we have something called the amphibious tractor or Amtrax. So it's like the Higgins boats, but with tracks on it, and it can essentially like crawl over the coral. Upon
Oh.
seeing this, the only surviving Japanese officer, Lieutenant Tenura Hideo, would go on to say, quote, "We could see the American landing craft coming towards us like dozens of spiders over the surface of the water," as one of my men exclaimed, "The gods of death have come," as the Marines reached the beach. And if that is not the most metal thing I've ever heard,
Yeah.
oh,
And you know the
could
Marines were
you
like,
imagine?
they called us gods of death. I mean,
Right.
our boys call us devil dogs, but gods of death, we'll take it.
We'll take it, right?
That's an
That works
upgrade.
for us, right? So these Marines that he's talking about, they strike the beach under a hailstorm of fire from the Japanese. And it is worth pointing out that before they storm the beach, there has already been like significant aerial bombing to this area, just in hopes to help take a little bit of edge off of what the Marines have to do here. So
Right.
they're kind of surprised when they get there and there's still 4,500 Japanese Marines waiting for them. They're like, excuse me, what? But
Could you
anyway.
kindly die? We did a lot of work to get here.
Could you just lay there and die? So these Marines he's talking about, like I said, they strike the beach under a hailstorm of fire coming from the Japanese. Like I said, previously already bombed. The U.S. Marines entering the fray number at 18,000 Marines of the 2nd Division, which include
18
the
versus
2nd Marines,
45.
18,000 Marines versus 4,500.
Oh, 4,500. Okay. Just making sure we're playing with the right numbers.
Yes. So there's three landing parties in three specific areas. I'm only talking about one. There were actually way more Marines in this area at the time, but I'm just talking about these 18,000. So we have the 2nd Marine Division. It includes the 2nd Marines, the 6th Marines, the 8th Marines, which is infantry, the 10th Marines, which is artillery, and the 18th Marines, which are comprised of the Composite Engineering Regiment. And one duck that Sergeant Francis Pappy Fagan picked up 2,964.5 miles away in New Zealand. Yeah, I said duck. A devil
I
duck,
mean,
if
you
you
know
will.
what? There's been a horse. There's been multiple dogs. The duck feels like an outlier, but I'm here for it.
Right?
The Polish had a
Okay.
bear.
Why not a duck? So, for my second set of sources, I give you the actual Marines military website, the USMarineCorps.com, the Marine who was an actual duck, a Mental Floss article called The Story of Siwash, the beer drinking duck who joined the Marines. And one of my very favorite YouTube channels, the Fat Electrician, Quack Attack of
Yes.
the Feathered Fighter of World War II.
He's amazing.
I love him so much. And then wearethemighty.com, beer drinking Marine Corps duck earns citation for Tarawa fighting. I just love this duck so much. Okay, so now that we're there, I got to get back to my parts and the notes. So there's basically two stories about how he comes to have a duck. The first one is that while Sergeant Francis Pappy Fagan is attending establishments, that's an establishment that serves adult beverages, where one can absolutely not get into trouble, as he was being an exemplary member of the armed forces,
You
who
said
are not known
Marine.
to
We know
drink
that this is a
ever.
lie.
Anyway, he walks into this establishment and he purchases a sarsaparilla, or maybe a 7-Up, whatever, and a raffle ticket. Well, the story goes that he wins the raffle and the prize is a duck. We're unclear why.
We're unclear why the prize was a duck or why.
Why the prize was a duck. I guess it's just a New Zealand thing. More likely, and my favorite, is the story that Sergeant Francis Poppy Fagan was at the bar with the boys getting schnockered and playing poker and winning. Because, like, why not? They know they're about to go into one of the most intense battles of the entire war. So during the game, they evidently clean the locals out, who are now like, oh crap, we got to win our money back. So they put up a duck. Pappy wins. And to quote the Fat Electrician, And by extension, so do the Marines. They now have a doc. He is immediately given the rank of sergeant, and Sergeant Fagan, or Pappy as his nickname, names him Jack Seawash Cornelius after the real G is Jack Seawash Cornelius. Now, I googled the name, but only the duck comes up. So my assumption is that the human Jack Cornelius was probably a friend of Sergeant Fagan's, but I don't know for sure.
What would be hilarious if the original Fagin didn't hit Sergeant yet and the duck outranked him?
He's just like standing there as a private. That would be hilarious.
It's like, I'm looking for Sergeant Fagin. That's you, right? N no. To my left. Look down.
Down, down.
Little bit lower. His eyes are down here, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. However, with all that being said, I will be calling the duck Cornelius or Jack, or more likely Sergeant from this point on, because as I understand it, the word Siwash is a derogatory name for Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest now.
Oh.
So, for the sake of being kind to that, I will not refer to him that unless I am quoting someone from that time. So Sergeant like loves Fagin and he follows him everywhere. I think even to training, because he quickly learns how to like jump in and out of the foxholes and very quickly becomes the mascot of the Second Marines. And as such, he learns how to drink, as you do,
You
because
know what? This
Marines,
checks.
right? Fagin would later go on to say to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in 1944, quote, "Siwash just can't pass up a free drink." He goes on to say, "A long one and a short one, that's the limit, but he doesn't know it. He won't touch draft beer though, and it's got to be warm the way it is in New Zealand." The duck's got taste, okay?
Yeah, he's grown accustomed to a certain kind of lifestyle.
In fact, so when his unit storms the beach on the second day at Bashio, there was no question that Sarge wouldn't be right behind Fagin, and he almost immediately locks eyes with a rooster of, quote, "Japanese ancestry," and they engage in wing-to-wing combat. And if that is not the stupidest sentence I've ever written in my life. In an article for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Fagin is quoted as saying the rooster didn't have a chance. Siwash whipped him and chased him 30 feet up the beach. Siwash took a few beatings in the face because of that rooster, but anyway, after the battle, the boys wanted a Purple Heart for Sarge. However, in the end, he was awarded this citation for courageous actions and wounds received on Tarawe in the Gilbert Islands in November of 1943, with utter disregard for his own personal safety. Siwash, upon reaching the beach without hesitation, engaged the enemy in fierce combat, namely one rooster of Japanese ancestry, and though wounded on the head by repeated pecks, he soon routed the opposition. He refused medical aid until all wounded members of his section had been taken care
If
of.
this duck outranks you and has more medals than you, that has got to be a kick in the teeth.
I love it so much. This wasn't the only battle he fought in. He would be around for at least two more, but during the Battle of Saipan, he stayed on the boat. Unclear why. However, during the battle for Tinian, he captured a, quote, "tiny Jap duck." And roughly 30 days later, she would lay an egg, and that's when the boys figured out she lied about her gender to enlist. At this point, her fighting days are over, and later that year, she would make it to the United States and given a hero's welcome. Her welcome included two radio appearances, a luncheon, and all the beer she could ever want. Fagin and Siwash go on to travel and promote the sale of war bonds, which I think is amazing. After World War II, Sargent moved into the Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo, where she enjoyed the rest of her life. She
She?
died of liver problems.
Wait, so baby mama did the media tour.
Did the media tour.
Okay, and
Yep,
then
she sure
she,
did.
the
Retired.
alcoholism got her eventually.
in 1954. I can't love this duck more. Her body was stuffed and her funeral held at the taxidermist office. And then it was presented to the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Triangle, Virginia. Would you like me to read her obituary? Because yes, she got one.
If she has a better bit, no, I'm joking. Carry on. Go ahead. Go ahead. Yes.
Siwash dies in zoo 11 years after she joined the Marines. Siwash, the duck mascot of the 2nd Marine at Tarawa, Saipan, and Tinian in World War II, died in the Lincoln Park Zoo Sunday. Death was attributed to a liver ailment, which Marine veterans said had no connection with Siwash's fondness for beer.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I just
Zoo.
realized something. This whole time, I thought Siwash got out, overtook another duck. That duck was captured and then later gave birth to it or laid an egg. And then,
She did.
but hear me. I assumed Siwash male the entire time. The other duck was captured. Other duck had laid egg. Other duck went to the US, not
No.
the main character. I
The
felt like we
main
had.
character.
So the main character is the one who lied about gender, because I was assuming we assumed that the
Yes.
Japanese duck lied about gender to enlist.
No. No,
Okay, I'm with you
our
now. I'm
girl,
with you now. I'm with you now.
Sergeant lied about her gender because Marines are Marines. Because Marines. So, zoo director Marlon Perkins held up announcement of Siwash's death according to military custom until he notified Francis J. Fagan, 34, of 8212 Cornell Avenue, the official next of kin.
I like how we doxed him.
Fagan, now a city electrician, was a Marine corporal when he acquired Siwash in New Zealand in a New Zealand tavern in 1943. After the war, Siwash was taken to a farm but didn't like it. Marine veterans brought her to Chicago to help with recruitment for the Korean War. Since then, she had lived at the zoo. Arrangements had been made with the San Diego, California Zoo to be host to Siwash during the 2nd Marine Division reunion in July. Services will be held in a taxidermist shop. It makes it so happy.
Maybe I want my services held in a taxidermist shop.
Just want my obituary to say that.
You can hold it anywhere, but just write, and I quote.
You just please, please, and thank you. A final note about the Battle of Torare. It would take 18,000 Marines, one duck, and 72 hours to take the island, which was quite a big difference from the million men 100 years. However, I did want to give a shout out to the Japanese here. Only 17 Japanese troops survived, and Admiral Shibusaki died like night one, and it is believed that it was his death and the ensuing chaos that gave us the edge to win.
Wow.
And I when I was reading the story, like there's some pretty intense images. In fact, the documentary that they made for this battle caused it did its job essentially. It caused the war bond sales to skyrocket because people were so horrified by what they saw. The downside to that is it caused the numbers for enlisting Marines to dwindle because nobody wanted to go and fight in the Pacific Theater after having seen the
Right.
pictures and the, and whatnot.
They're like, maybe the army's good for me. The Asia has a lot of water. I'm gonna vote for maybe elsewhere.
So with that said, I do have a couple pictures because how could I not?
Yeah. Please and thank you.
I start
I'm hoping we have
here.
some Sergeant Stubby type photos where the duck has her own jacket.
So this is the group of remaining surviving Japanese troops, giving up, not giving up, but they're being held, so now
Right.
they're prisoners, right? And I just thought that picture was so, it got me, right? Like
Yeah.
we don't really see human toll today like
Right.
we do for that. But it's just a whole different thing. But the guy on the far left's face says to me in a moment of humanity or in a moment of humorous humanity, "Crap, I got beat by a duck." And I just can't get over the look on his face right there.
I mean, I have a
But
feeling
it
it's a bit
is,
bigger than that, but I mean, we can be reductionist and say it's the duck.
I think it's much bigger than that, but that was the first thought that came to my mind when I saw the look specifically on his face. Everybody else, yeah, I totally get. But again, I do want to honor them because they fought, and it wasn't until here that we fully understood what they were willing to give up for their goals.
Right.
There
Well,
were
and
4,500 of them, only 17 survived.
there's also like they're just people fighting for their government, and their government is the one with this agenda, this idea. Just like our government is the one with the agenda and the idea, and we're just the grunts.
And I just, these guys, I mean, I can't only imagine what's going through their minds and what the rest of their lives look like. Here's Sergeant herself. She's
She's
just chilling. That is
beautiful.
actually on the beach. That is on Bastio Beach. She's just
Okay,
hanging out, living her
so
best life.
she is a fairly dark colored duck with a white neck and the top of her chest. Bill slightly open, probably mid quack.
The fat electrician had this to say, and it made me laugh so hard that I had to include it in my notes. The Marine Corps won a duck in a poker game, taught it how to drink beer, and then took it to multiple amphibious landings in the deadliest battles of World War II, kept it alive the entire time to bring it home so they could use it to hit on women. And I think that's the most Marine Corps thing that has ever happened.
You know, look, they are good at what they do.
You know, right? Okay, so here is her and the boys.
Oh, okay, so there are two obviously clean-shaven men, and they are adoring, one is adoringly holding the duck up, letting it perch on his arm. And the other one is with the kindest look on his face, holding up a shot glass, so to speak, and she has her bill deep in the glass.
My guess is, and I'm not 100% sure, but my guess is the one holding her is Fagin. I tried to find photos that could I could compare, but I couldn't find any with listing names, so I'm not entirely sure. But that's my story of Sergeant Siwash, the devil duck.
I love
Now,
her.
if you're curious to know, just recently, and this absolutely slayed me when I learned this information. Just recently, there was an event that took place, and I'm going to see if I can find the article because it's a hoot. There was a negligent discharge of a firearm at a Marine base in the last few years. No one was injured, which is awesome.
Okay, right.
They locked down the barracks, and upon investigation in one of the barrack rooms, they discovered a bathroom with no less than four baby ducks because Marines gonna Marine. Am unclear if the individual that fired the weapon was also the individual that has the ducks. I'm unclear, but
I doubt
when
it.
I
I
read
feel
that, his
like there's
little
multiple levels of shenanigans.
100%, that was exactly what I was going to say. And when I read just a little snippet of that article, I was like, you cannot be. This is fan freaking tastic. Could you imagine being the superior officer that has to go in that bathroom and discover that there is not one, not two, not three, but four ducks living on the Marine base, hidden in some dude's bathroom? Because Marines. And quite honestly, are you gonna tell him no? Like,
I
I'm
mean,
not.
actually,
Live your
yes,
best
as their
life.
commanding officer and more Marine than the Marine, yeah, I would. I would be like, maybe not, sir.
I don't have it. I'd be like, explain yourself, but actually, no, you know what? The less I know, the better. Just
So that
Go
does remind
on
me,
about your day.
in college, I had gone home for Christmas, and we'd asked my aunt what she wanted for Christmas, and she said she wanted a laptop mouse. My sister said, "Okay, Teresa, I got an idea. I want you to actually go get the actual device that she wants, and just go with me and make sure yours is hidden." And I went, "Okay." So she hands my aunt on Christmas morning a box, roughly the size of a shoebox, a little bit bigger than a shoebox. My aunt holds it. And she's like, "Okay," because she knows what she asked for. She knows it was within our budget. And she's curious as to why this is a much larger container. And she opens it, and it's a very small terrarium with a live white mouse. And it in Sharpie is written laptop. And she goes, "It's a laptop mouse. It's a laptop mouse. And it's in a container big enough for your lap. This is what you asked for."
Literally, can't go wrong
And
here.
then I handed her the actual box. But then it was like, "Well, what do we do with this animal?" And it was like, "Well,
Fair.
I guess I'll take him to college." Now, of course, the dorms had a strict no pet policy, and we had room checks.
Lord Byron, looking at you.
Right. And so, I mean, wasn't a bear. But I was like, "Okay, I'm gonna take this mouse," and I named him Jack. And whenever we had room checks, I made sure that Jack was hidden. Well, one day Jack got out, and my roommate and I diligently found him and put him back in the cage. Well, then I come back a week later from work or whatever, and Jack's container is not on my desk. I was like, "Huh, maybe we had a surprise room check and my roommate hid him." And then I hear a knock, knock, knock. I hear my RA's voice. "Teresa, can you step into my room?" I walk in there, and she shuts the door to her room, and she opens her closet, and there's this container. And she goes, "What can you tell me about that?" I said, "Oh, that's Jack."
Been
And
looking for
she
him.
says, "What else can you tell me?" And I said, I can go home this weekend and you'll never see him again." I did not go home that weekend, and she did not ever see him again.
Did
And
you
then
hide him?
I hid him better. And so then that summer, she and I were roommates off campus, and she goes, "Oh, you brought Jack from home." And I said, "Funny story, Jack never left. Your room checks suck."
You could do better.
Yeah. And now that I've completely shattered your confidence in your ability to do your job, he's a sweetheart. You can hold him now.
Meet Jack. You've earned the right to hold him.
Yeah.
I love you, Jack. My child, the other day, I often do my homework sitting at the kitchen counter, and I was in the living room, and we have like the wall that separates the living room from the kitchen, so you just walk around it to get into, either room,
Yeah.
but you can't see the kitchen from the living room. And he yells to me, this is big, yells to me, "Mom, there's a dead mouse in the kitchen." And my first thought is he is messing with me. My very next thought is, how is there a dead mouse in the kitchen? And then I realized he hadn't weed-eated the yard and a few weeks, so maybe there is. There's never been a mouse in my house before, and we have way too many cats for that to be a thing. So I get up and I walk in there, and he is so proud of himself. He is standing next to my surface with my mouse belly up. It's dead. That this is my house on any given day. He was so proud of himself.
Yep. Our families can easily hang out regularly because this is the kind of hell that I live in as well.
I wouldn't have it any other way. Yeah. This is also the same kid, mind you, that called me panicking one day in a sheer panic because there was a windstorm and the umbrella and the outdoor table that it was attached to were in the pool. And he didn't know how to handle his life. So I know that if there was a dead mouse in the kitchen, he would have panicked and not been so chill about it.
I
So I
mean, you
got that
say
going for
that,
me.
You say that, but I know if he is anything like me, which I hope to hell he's not, the smallest inconvenience will cause an absolute meltdown. But if I roll up on, say, a very substantial car accident, I am deadly calm and just go right into
Yeah.
action and handle it.
Yeah, no. That's him. Yeah, that's him. In a nutshell. You want to know? I experienced how our ADHDs work very differently the other day, and it was so enlightening, enlightening to see.
Enlightening.
Yeah.
It
He
enlightens you.
it enlightened me. My husband works for a casino, and I do not like ever going there, unless we're going bowling or something like that. But I can't deal with the mass amounts of sounds and stimuli. Like, it super stresses me out. On the other hand, we went through the casino the other evening to have dinner in one of the restaurants, and the Ethan got to walk across the gaming floor to get there. I have never seen a child happier in my life. He was smiling from ear to ear, and he looked over at Ian and said, "Oh my gosh, listen to all the sounds. I want to touch all the things. This is amazing."
Sensory
And I
seeking
went,
versus sensory avoiding.
yeah. I was like, "Wow, we are so different." And Owen's like holding my hand. "It's okay, Mom. We'll make it through. It's okay." Yeah. So, note to self, we have to keep him out of the casino because he could actually hang out there and enjoy his time.
Right?
Bit of a problem, but he's cute, so what are you going to do?
Your best. That's all you really can do.
In fact, so here we are.
Well, if you've enjoyed your time here and you're like, oh my goodness, there are ducks in the Marine Corps, there are bodies maybe all together being flung over walls. This is
Or not.
incredible. I need more of this or more of understanding what this may or may not be. You can email us at unhinged.historypod@gmail.com. You can rate, review, subscribe, and tell your favorite duck breeder about how ducks may or may not be impacted by large amounts of booze given to them by Marines over a period of years. And on that note,
I will take no questions.
goodbye.
Goodbye.